afraid of the dark? Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the history and paranormal while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraid-ish together. Hello and welcome to bonus episode 5. I'm Paul.
And I'm Ashley.
So we just recorded the intro to the Springfield National Cemetery part 3.
Episode 3 of the Springfield National Cemetery saga.
And last Monday was Ashley's birthday.
Yay.
As we recorded, as we record this, it hasn't happened yet. But we did just come from her surprise birthday party, so that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was
a huge surprise.
Very, very big surprise.
Yes. All right.
Very, yes. Very shocked.
And in the last episode, I forgot to thank Lauren and Rachel and
Jen,
Jessica and Jen, and thanks to Grayson and Maddie for coming out.
Yeah,
and everybody else who came out. It was a lot of fun. Yeah,
it was a blast.
And I am drinking a Beatbox Tropical Punch,
and
it's very good.
Yeah, the Beatboxes are really good. I'm drinking a Monaco Black Raspberry cocktail. It's pretty good.
Sounds good, yeah. And in this episode, we'll recap the Texas episodes and dive into some extra info.
Okay.
In episode 17, I talked about the Swenson House in Abilene, Texas. And
yes.
I'll talk about the hauntings for that.
Okay.
The Swenson House, with its rich history and the gentle presence of the female spirit, believed to be Shirley Swenson, has become a fascinating location in the city known for its haunted house tours. Shirley Swenson, having lived there with her husband, William, until her passing, seems to continue to enjoy the house even in her afterlife. Her friendly and benign nature, along with her involvement in various activities and love for social events while alive, has made her spirit a welcoming presence for the living.
Yeah.
The apparition of Shirley is often described as a lady dressed in gray and is frequently seen floating up and down the staircases, indicating her attachment to the house and her previous life there. She also seems to be responsible for the doors and windows opening and closing by themselves, as if trying to keep the air flowing through the house.
Ah.
Moreover, she playfully rearranges items to her liking and occasionally switches the lights on and off. I forgot to mention that I had 4 margaritas before this at the party, so.
4 margaritas.
4 margaritas.
Well, happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. The Swenson House's paranormal activities have contributed to its popularity on haunted house tours. However, the Abilene Preservation League and the Swenson House Historical Society have not officially embraced the haunted house title, perhaps to maintain the historical significance and preserve the legacy of the house rather than emphasizing the paranormal aspect.
Yeah.
During Halloween, the Swenson House hosts a family-friendly haunted house event where actors dress in spooky costumes and create a scary atmosphere for visitors. This event takes advantage of the house's reputation and popularity among ghost enthusiasts to provide a fun and thrilling experience for people of all ages.
Yes.
Additionally, activities are planned on the house's grounds, further enriching the experience for those attending. And overall, the Swenson House has become a place where history and the paranormal merge, attracting visitors interested in both aspects. Whether it's exploring the alleged sighting of Shirley Swenson's ghost or enjoying the Halloween festivities, the house continues to play a significant role in the city's cultural and social life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I it's been over a year since we went to the Swenson house.
Yeah.
But I very much enjoyed being there. The house felt very nice.
Yeah.
Except for the room that used to be his office.
Oh, yeah.
I felt like I was not supposed to be in there.
I don't know if it's the feeling of, like, a lot of masculinity in that area.
No, it was the women aren't supposed to be in here. Get out. This is the man's.
Yeah.
It was very much that.
Could be. Who knows?
But the rest of the house was really nice.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun going down there. All right, in episode 18, I talked about the Hotel Wooten in Abilene.
That was the Ankle Alley.
Oh, yeah. That was funny.
Or Ankle Acre, whatever.
Ankle Acre. It seems like Hotel Wooten in downtown Abilene has quite a haunted history, with various paranormal experiences reported by both tenants and visitors. The presence of the full-bodied apparition of a young male bellhop, along with the sightings of a woman in an old-fashioned dress suggests there might be lingering spirits from the hotel's past. The laughter and ballroom music heard when no one around indicates residual hauntings, which are recordings of the past events imprinted on the environment. These occurrences don't interact with the living and simply replay certain moments from the past. The fact that the 13th floor is considered the most haunted and no one wants to live there further reinforces the idea that something unusual might be happening there.
Hmm.
The elevator stopping on that floor without anyone pushing the button is particularly eerie and adds to the ghostly atmosphere. It's interesting to note that the experiences mentioned by the current resident are not isolated incidents. Others in the building have also encountered similar phenomena, including the sightings of a female apparition wandering the premises. This collective experience points to the high likelihood of genuine paranormal activity within the hotel.
Hmm.
Based on the description of the encounters, the experiences don't seem malevolent or harmful, but rather residual and benign. However, it's essential for individuals experiencing these occurrences. God, I can't talk. As usual. Fuck me. However, it's essential for individuals experiencing these occurrences to remain cautious and respectful of the spirits, and not all hauntings are the same. And some may have different intentions or energy. Overall, the Hotel Wooten appears to have rich history and an equally vibrant supernatural presence, making it a captivating location for those interested in the paranormal.
So, isn't it made out of limestone?
I forgot. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's made out of limestone.
Could be.
At least the exterior, which people always talk about how, like, limestone and water.
Yeah.
Like, limestone and or running water are, like, prime real estate for paranormal activity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, in episode 19, I talked about the Paramount Theater in Abilene, which was owned by the same person as the Hotel Wooten.
Yes.
The stories of spirits returning to old and historic structures, especially those that have been restored or renovated, are not uncommon in folklore and paranormal beliefs. Many people find comfort in the idea that the souls of those who once cherished a place can still be present, enjoying the changes and improvements made to it. With its rich history of performances and emotional connections, the theater can indeed be a place where such spirits might linger. The deep fondness for the theatrical arts and the gentle demeanor of these spectral theater enthusiasts
theater
as described in the belief adds to an intriguing layer to the stories surrounding the Paramount Theater. The presence of the portrait of a woman with a passion for the theater, potentially containing supernatural energy, is another interesting aspect. Such beliefs about images capturing the essence of the person depicted have been around in various cultures and folklore. In this context, it adds to the mystique of the theater and its potential connection to the spiritual realm. What?
I'm listening.
Oh, I thought you had something to say about the portrait
thing. Well, no, it's just like, yeah, you hear, like, when, I don't know about portraiture, but when photography was first, like, becoming popularized, people didn't trust it. They didn't want to have their photos taken because they were afraid that it would, like, capture a part of their soul.
There's that, and I've also heard about a lot of haunted, like, old-timey portraits of, like, it's crazy. Like, the, what is it, the crying kid or some shit like that. Anyways, there's a lot of them that's supposedly haunted.
Cursed and...
Cursed. It's all cursed. Fucking cursed. This
fucking world's cursed, honestly. It is.
The spirits of Wally Aiken and Horace O. Wooten, both with their ties to the theater, seem to find pride and satisfaction in the restoration and live performances now take place on the stage. Their alleged presence, along with other spectral attendees, can create an aura of wonder and mystery around the theater, adding to its allure for both the living and those who might linger from beyond. Reports of footsteps on the central stairs leading to the balcony during the early hours before the theater opens, as well as the strange occurrences in the balcony area after the curtains have closed, contribute to the theater's eerie reputation. Such tales of unexplained sounds and sightings are typical in ghost lore, often add the overall charm and haunted appeal to a place. The photographs capturing the photographs capturing mysterious orbs are a common phenomenon often associated with paranormal occurrences. While some skeptics may attribute these to dust or camera artifacts, others find them intriguing and see them as potential evidence of the supernatural.
What is, pray tell, a camera artifact?
It's like...
like lens flares?
Lens flares and like glare from like light and stuff, yeah.
Okay. Just
random shit.
Like people on Instagram with their like intentional lens flares. Like you can... They're shining their camera into like the setting sun or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
They're like, oh, look at this orb. It's following my hand around. And I'm like, no, ma'am. That is a lens flare.
People are dumb.
Yeah. You're stupid.
Yep. Anyway. Curse
me up.
It's important to note that such beliefs and stories contribute to the folklore and mystique surrounding historic theaters and other old structures. While many people find fascination and enjoyment in these tales, they remain in the realm of folklore and personal beliefs, and there is no scientific evidence to substantiate the existence of spirits or ghosts.
I mean, there's no scientific evidence to substantiate the existence of consciousness, and yet here we are. Yeah.
I'm just saying.
I know, I'm also just saying.
Yeah. I'm surprised we're not sidetracking a lot on this episode.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of tired, so...
I know.
Me
too, after this...
feel like 30 pounds lighter?
I do. It's like the whole, like, keeping a surprise party a secret for 2 months.
From me.
From you, who, like, tries to...
I don't try.
Who miraculously figures shit out.
I don't try. That's the thing. Like, I've never, like, set out to be like, I'm going to crack this case. It's just, you asked me, do people give gifts for Halloween? I said, you're getting me a cat, aren't you?
Yeah. Yep.
And you drew a box in the air, and I said, oh, you're getting me a record player for Christmas, aren't you?
Yep.
I don't know, man. It's
this is the only surprise that I've gotten away with, so.
The only reason, I'm going to tell you right now, because I've been, like, sad. So I haven't been, like, perceptive.
Yeah. You needed it, and it was fun.
It was a good time. It was a really good time.
All right. In episode 20, Ashley talked about the history of the Alamo, and I talked about the hauntings.
Yes.
The Alamo is a historic site in San Antonio, Texas, known for its significant role in the Texas Revolution. The Battle of the Alamo took place from February 23rd to March 6th, 1836, during which a small group of Texan defenders, including famous figures like William B. Travis, James Bowie, and Davy Crockett, held the mission against a much larger Mexican force led by General Santa Anna. The Texan defenders were eventually defeated, and the battle became a rally cry for Texan independence.
I have a question.
Yes.
We were watching, was it Good Omens? Where he mentioned being at the Alamo, and somebody gave him something.
It might have been.
I think it was Good Omens.
Probably.
Anyway.
It's a good show, by the way, if anybody's
I think ever seen it was it. Good Omens.
I don't know. The reported ghostly activities and sightings at the Alamo are part of local legends and ghost stories passed down through generations. These stories have become a part of the site's folklore and attract visitors interested in paranormal phenomena. Here's a brief overview of the different entities that are said to haunt the Alamo. Flaming spirits. Mm-hmm. According to the legend, Mexican troops were sent to destroy the Alamo after the Battle of San Jacinto. However, they were confronted by six fully formed flaming spirits in front of the mission, warning them not to touch the Alamo.
Mm-hmm.
The Mexicans were frightened and retreated, refusing to return. That would be a hell of a view, vision, or...
That visual. Would make me afraid-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drop the ish. That'd that would crazy. Make me afraid.
I'd probably pee my pants. There's the cowboy. A spirit of a cowboy is often spotted in the gardens near the mission. He appears to be drenched as if he has ridden through a severe thunderstorm. Texas historians speculate that he might have been one of the 22 dispatch riders sent by William Travis to seek assistance. The Alamo Defender. This entity is frequently seen sticking his head and shoulders out of a large rectangular window above the double doors at the front of the church. He then vanishes after briefly observing the surroundings. There's the blonde-haired boy.
Mm-hmm.
A small boy that with blonde hair is often sighted in the left upstairs window, which now houses the gift shop. He is seen mainly during the first few weeks of February. Some believe he was evacuated during the siege and returns annually, searching for his deceased father who died in the battle.
Hmm.
The woman by the water well. Another apparition is reported to be seen next to the water well on the opposite side of the church. This restless spirit appears only at night and is described as a vaporous torso-like figure. Her identity remains unknown. The Tall Indian. In an area of the mission used for storage and meetings, staff members have encountered the spirit of a tall Native American who silently creeps up behind them.
Hmm.
After feeling his presence, he disappears or walks back through a solid wall. Once a tunnel doorway leading to the Menger Hotel across the street.
Mm-hmm.
These ghostly sightings and stories add to the allure and mystique of the Alamo, attracting visitors intrigued by its rich history and potential paranormal activity. The Alamo remains a significant historical site, and visitors can explore its rich history and learn about the events during the Texas Revolution. Yeah, if anybody gets the chance to visit Texas and go to San Antonio, you should definitely visit.
I mean, don't visit Texas.
Well.
But visit San Antonio. Fuck Texas.
Yes, I know how you feel. Anyways. Well, those are the episodes.
Huh.
And here are more fun facts about the Lone Star State. Number one. Texas was once an independent nation known as the Republic of Texas, which existed from 1836 to 1845. before it joined the United States as the 28th state on December 29th, 1845. So, yeah. Number two, Houston, Texas is home to NASA's Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center, where human spaceflight training and mission control operations take place.
Houston, we have a problem.
Houston. Lyndon Big Dick Johnson Space Center. You get it?
Yes, I do get it.
Anyways. All right. Number three. The State Fair of Texas, held annually in Dallas, features an iconic 55-foot-tall talking cowboy statue named Big Tex.
No, thank you.
It has been an emblem of the fair since 1952.
I'll pass.
I've seen like him on like TV shows and movies and shit. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Not interested.
Number four. Texas is often referred to as the Lone Star State because of the single star on its flag, which symbolizes the state's independent spirit and pride.
Then why don't they go be independent?
I know.
I'm sorry.
Jesus Christ, woman. I'm sorry. Ashley hates Texas with a passion. I know, I get it.
If you know, you know.
You know, you know. Anyways, number five. Texas has a long tradition of cattle ranching, and it played a vital role in the development of the American cattle industry in the 19th century. Number six, the Texas Medical Center in Houston is the largest medical complex in the world.
Interesting.
Yep. Number seven, the Texas State Railroad is one of the oldest continuously operating steam engines in the U.S. And operates vintage steam and diesel trains. They offer scenic rides in the Piney Woods region in East Texas.
I mean, that's cool. But we've been seeing some antique train activity in our modern trains here of late. Yeah. And I don't know. I'd have a hard time.
I guess you'd have to see it. I don't know.
No, I just have a hard time trusting an antique train.
I don't know. All right. Anyways, number eight. The Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport is one of the busiest airports in the world.
Yeah.
And the Port of Houston is one of the busiest ports in the world.
Yeah. Lots of cruise ships going in and out of that motherfucking place.
Yeah. Number nine. In Mesquite, Texas, giving unused clothing to your friends is illegal.
The fuck?
These are these crazy laws.
Texas can kiss my dick.
In El Paso, Texas, churches, hotels, halls of assembly, stores, markets, banking rooms, railroad depots, and saloons are required to provide spittoons.
Gross.
This is one of the old laws from back in...
God, could you imagine sitting in church and all them dudes sitting around you just like hawking their nasty ass tobacco spit into a spittoon?
That is gross.
You want to find a way to chase people out of a church? Put spittoons in a church.
Yep. Pretty much. Number 10. A Texas statute bans the possession, sale, or distribution of realistic-looking dildos. And you can't own more than six dildos at a time.
I just want... Is there a task force charged with,
as
like,
if they're going to come in and look for more than six anyways.
Excuse me, ma'am. I hear tell that you've got 15 dildos up in this here house. We're going to have to come and search your home. Fuck you.
It's one of those crazy ass laws.
How do they, like, why are these laws on the book? Like, I understand, but also, like, why?
Yeah, there are a bunch of laws like that that are about to be, like, taken off the books because they're so fucking
stupid.
Not
in Texas. They're probably going to start enforcing that shit.
Who knows?
Especially if they think you're gay.
Yeah. That'd be more like a Florida governor type of thing, but...
no. Abbott's just as bad.
Yeah. Anyways. All right. There have been so many famous people born in Texas. It was hard to choose who to pick for this list, so I just randomly chose some. And then I will end with a couple of historical figures. Literally, I could go down a freaking list of hundreds of famous people. Mm-hmm. But here's a few. Willie Nelson, born in Abbott, Texas, on April 30th, 1933. Damn. Matthew McConaughey, born in Uvalde, Texas, on November 4th, 1969.
I didn't know he was from Uvalde.
Yeah, I think he did help a little bit.
Well, I know, like, yeah. When that happened, he got really involved. I didn't know that that was his hometown.
Yeah. Steve Martin, born in Waco, Texas, on August 14th, 1945. Huh? Love Steve Martin.
Love Steve Martin.
Selena Gomez, born in Grand Prairie, Texas, on July 22nd, 1992.
Okay.
For you wrestling fans, The Undertaker, a.k.a. The Master of Pain, a.k.a. The Punisher, a.k.a. Mark William Calloway, was born in Houston, Texas, on March 24th, 1965. Patrick Swayze, born in Houston, Texas, on August 18th, 1952. He died from pancreatic cancer on September 14th, 2009.
Yes.
Janis Joplin, born in Port Arthur, Texas, on January 19th, 1943. She was found dead on October 4th, 1970, in a hotel room in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. It was said that she died due to an overdose of heroin, possibly compounded by alcohol.
Yes.
She's a great singer, too.
Yep.
Selena, another great singer.
Yes.
Born in Lake Jackson, Texas, on April 16th, 1971. Yolanda Saldivar, the president of Selena's fan club and the manager of Selena's boutiques, was about to be fired for embezzling $60,000. On March 31st, 1995, she shot Selena in an act of supposed vengeance. The bullet hit her right lower shoulder. She died of blood loss and cardiac arrest on the same day. Yeah. So sad. Yeah. All right. Here is the first historical person. His name is Scott Joplin. Scott Joplin is believed to have been born around late 1867 to mid-1868 in northeastern Texas. His father, Giles Joplin, was a former slave who, at the time of Scott's birth, worked at a tenant farmer in East Texas. His mother, Florence Givens, was freeborn. He was the second child of six children. Yeah. He had an elder brother named Monroe and four younger siblings, Robert, Josie, William, and Johnny. Nothing is known about his childhood except that he grew up on the farm listening to his father. Listening to his father playing the violin and his mother the banjo. He too learned to play the banjo. However, they did not remain there for long. In the June 1880 census, we find the family located in the newly established town of Texarkana.
Oh.
While it is not known when exactly they made the move, some sources believe it to be in 1875. It's crazy how back in those days they didn't really keep records, especially with African American people.
No.
It sucks though, but. There he started going to school while his father and elder brother worked as railroad laborers. Hmm. To supplement the family income, his mother took up house cleaning and laundry. And it was at one of her employer's house that young Scott first started tinkling with a piano. Yeah. He was allowed to play the instrument while his mother cleaned the house. He was by then 7 years of age.
Jeez.
By 11, he had become proficient enough to draw the attention of a German piano teacher, Julius Weiss. Soon, Weiss started giving him lessons in piano, ear training, sight reading, and harmony at no cost.
Wow.
A gesture Scott Joplin never forgot. Weiss also introduced him to the world of classical music, especially opera. When lumberman Colonel R.W. Rogers, with whom he lodged, bought a new piano, he made sure that the old square one was sold to the Joplins at a discounted rate. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Very soon, young Scott was spending his spare time on the newly acquired instrument, which caused friction in the household. While Florence encouraged her son to pursue a career in music, Giles wanted him to learn something practical, as most fathers do.
Yeah.
Sometime in the early 1880s, Giles moved in with another woman. Meanwhile, Scott continued to study with Weiss until the latter's departure in 1884. Therefore, Scott, too, left for Sedalia. I'm going to say Missouri.
I was going to say.
Because he went to St. Louis as well. Mm. By September 1884, he returned home to work as an assistant teacher at the Negro School. That's what they called it back then. Or maybe as a railroad laborer. He remained in the area possibly until 1888, performing in a vocal quartet and playing the piano in and around Texarkana. In around 1888, Scott Joplin left Texarkana to become an itinerant pianist. Quickly, he discovered that nobody would give him scope to black musicians. Nonetheless, he continued to travel around playing the piano in different brothels in various Midwestern towns, spending a large part of this period in St. Louis.
Mm.
In July 1891, he might have briefly returned to Texarkana. Records mention him as a member of the Texarkana Minstrels, raising money for a monument to Jefferson Davis. In 1893, he attended the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, forming a band for which he arranged the music and played the cornet, which is a brass instrument closely related to the trumpet.
Yes.
However, it is not known if they were actually able to perform at the exposition because the involvement of the African-American was kept minimal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Although African-Americans had little opportunity to perform at the exposition, they had ample chance for showcasing their music at the saloons, cafes, and brothels that lined the fair. Could you imagine having a brothel like lined up at the fair?
I mean, why the fuck not, right?
Yeah.
Because fairs back then weren't like what we think of when we think of fair.
Right. They mostly showcase like new stuff, like new inventions and stuff.
Yeah. Technology and stuff like that. And like, I mean, the Chicago Fair, the one that H.H. Holmes
eventually we will get to there.
Not to go off on that tangent, but I'm just saying, like, that was very, it wasn't like there weren't whirly gigs and elephant ears.
Yeah. There was a,
but I could see, I mean, why not put a brothel?
Yeah.
Or multiple.
That would make you a lot of money.
All them people coming in from out of town to go visit the fair. Meet me in St. Louis.
Yep. It was also during the exposition that he first met Otis Saunders, who encouraged him to write down and publish his songs. When the fair ended, the two musicians moved to Sedalia, where they continued to perform. Mm. Scott Joplin remained at Sedalia for several years, earning his keep as a piano teacher. Among his students were future composers like Arthur Marshall, Scott Hayden, and Brune Campbell. He also formed the 8-member Texas Medley Quartet, in which two of his younger brothers, Robert and Will, also participated.
Oh, cute!
That's pretty cool. From 1894 to 1896, he traveled around with Texas Medley Quartet, performing in various places. Meanwhile, in 1895, he managed to publish two of his songs, Please Say You Will, and A Picture of Her Face. In the following year, he had 3 more songs, including The Great Crush Collision March, published. And if you... it's basically ragtime music. I'm not familiar with that kind of music. So if anybody knows that.
You're not familiar with ragtime music?
Well, I mean, like, the names of the songs.
Oh,
and stuff.
Okay.
I've heard ragtime music, but I just don't know the names.
Yeah, okay. No, I don't know the names of any of the songs, but I know what ragtime music is.
I will get to the reason why he's famous.
Okay.
For what he did. In 1897, he enrolled in Sedalia's George R. Smith College for Negroes, studying piano and theory. Meanwhile, in 1898, he tried to sell two of his piano pieces, while only one original Rags was published. He was forced to share the credit with his staff arranger, Charles N. Daniels, of course.
God, that's
just... It's kind of ridiculous.
Man, I tell you.
In the summer of 1899, while working with the Maple Leaf Club in Sedalia, Scott Joplin came across a young lawyer, Robert Higdon. They together met music store owner and publisher John Stark, who eventually published Maple Leaf Rag under the stipulation that Joplin would receive a 1% royalty on each sale. The deal was signed on August 10, 1899, and although the initial sale was low, by 1900 it sold 500,000 copies, rendering Joplin a small but steady income for the rest of his life.
Nice!
Over time, Stark became one of his major publishers. It's pretty awesome.
Good for him.
In 1901, he relocated to St. Louis, where he published many of his important works, including Elite Syncopations, yep. The Entertainer, The Ragtime Dance, March Majestic, etc., etc., blah, blah. That's what the article said.
Mm-hmm.
Said etc. Sometime during this period, he also wrote his first opera called A Guest of Honor.
Yeah.
In 1903, he founded the Opera Company and undertook a national tour with a guest of honor even before its publication. Unfortunately, the box office receipts were stolen at some point in time. When he could not make the required payment, all his belongings, including the score, were confiscated.
God.
That's very sad. In 1907, Scott Joplin moved to New York City, where he started writing his second opera, Treemonisha, completing the piece by 1910. An idea ahead of time, the work celebrates African-American culture, concurrently stressing that education is the only way out for African-Americans.
Yeah.
Although the score of Treemonisha received a glowing full-page review in the American Musician and Art Journal in 1911, it was not fully performed in its lifetime. Its sole performance, a self-financed concert read-through in 1915, was a miserable failure.
Mm-hmm.
In December 1913, he founded the Scott Joplin Music Company. By that time, he knew that his days were numbered and started working feverishly, publishing Magnetic Rag in 1914 and Frolic of the Bears in 1915. However, most of the works he wrote in his final years are now lost.
Aww.
In 1899, Scott Joplin married his first wife, Belle Jones, with whom he had a daughter. The child died in 1903, leading to the divorce of her parents in early 1904. In June 1904, Joplin married Freddie Alexander. She died on September 10th, 1904, 10 weeks after their wedding, of complications resulting from a cold.
Damn!
That's ridiculous how people back then died from, like, natural, like, stuff that would be cured, like... Not, I mean, the cold isn't curable, but it's... I don't know.
The common cold normally ain't gonna kill you.
Yeah, it's crazy. In 1909, he married Lottie Stokes, remaining with her until his death in 1917. They did not have any children.
Mm.
Around 1904, Scott Joplin was first infected with syphilis which developed into neurosyphilis by 1916. In January 1917, he was admitted to Manhattan State Hospital and died there on April 1st of syphilitic dementia. He was buried in an unmarked pauper's grave in St. Michael's Cemetery in East Elmhurst.
Fuck.
In 1974, his grave was given a marker and his house in St. Louis was designated a U.S. National Historic Landmark in 1976.
If the grave was unmarked, how do they know where it was?
I don't know. It must have been marked with like a sticker. I don't know how that works. Huh. Maybe. Apparently they found it.
Cemetery somehow. Records or something.
Yeah. In 1983, the United States Postal Service issued a commemorative stamp of Scott Joplin as part of its Black Heritage series.
What year did you say?
1983.
Oh, I thought you said 1903. I was like, that was before he died.
1983. In 1987, he was inducted into the Big Band and Jazz Hall of Fame.
Aww.
So, Scott Joplin was the basically father of ragtime jazz.
Okay.
So that's why he was. That's why
I kind of figured that that's where you were going. Yeah.
All right. And finally, Bessie Coleman. Bessie Coleman was born on January 26, 1892, in Atlanta, Texas, to George and Susan Coleman, who worked as sharecroppers. A sharecropper is a tenant farmer, someone who works land that's rented from its owner. Typically, a sharecropper will pay the landowner with part of the harvest rather than money. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of how they did things back in medieval times, except you didn't pay with harvest. You sold the harvest and then paid your landlord.
Yeah. Her parents were George Coleman, part Cherokee, and Susan Coleman of African-American and Choctaw heritage. The family moved to Waxahachie, Texas, when she was only 2 years old. At the age of six, she attended a faraway one-room school in Waxahachie, walking 4 miles daily.
Fuck yeah. That.
Coleman was brilliant in mathematics and completed 8 grades in that school. In 1901, her father proposed to move back to Native Indian territory in Oklahoma to escape racial discrimination in Texas, but her mother decided to stay behind. To support her family, her mother started working as a cotton picker and a laundress. Bessie's two brothers started working as day laborers while she took care of her two younger sisters. When she was 12, she received a scholarship from Missionary Baptist Church School in Texas. She funded her studies at the Oklahoma Colored Agricultural and Normal University, now Langston University, by working as a laundress. However, she only had enough money for one semester, following which she returned home. After returning to Waxahachie, Bessie Coleman continued to work as a laundress until 1915, after which she moved to Chicago to live with her older brother, Walter. She found a job as a manicurist at the White Sox Barber Shop and soon moved to her own place.
Hmm.
While working as a manicurist, she heard stories about World War I from pilots returning from war.
Mm-hmm.
Coleman, who aspired to amount to something since she was a kid, decided that she would become a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
However, she soon learned that there were no flight schools in the United States that would admit a black
Absolutely
woman.
Absolutely none.
None of them.
Because racist and woman.
Yeah. She had developed a friendship with Robert S. Abbott, founder and publisher of the Chicago Defender. He informed her that the French were world leaders in aviation and would admit people from any race. She took up another job at a chili parlor to raise funds and also learned French.
A chili parlor?
Chili parlor. That's what it said.
Is that what I think it is?
Yeah.
I want to go to there.
Yeah. Have a chili parlor with different kinds of chilies. And that'd be cool.
Oh, just one kind of chili.
Yeah.
I just want to eat chili. Is it chili season yet? God, please.
No. Ugh. For me, it's too hot. It's 100 degrees outside.
I know. It's too hot for chili, but God damn it, I want it so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, she took up another job at a chili parlor to raise funds and also learned French at the Berlitz School in Chicago. On November 20th, 1920, she left for Paris, funded by Abbott and Jesse Binga, a realtor and a banker. She learned to fly in a Newport, N-I-E-U-P-O-R-T, Newport, 82, wow. Newport 82 biplane, and obtained her Fédération Aéronautique Internationale license. I can't speak French. I could barely speak English. That license on June 15th, 1921, from Caudron Brothers School of Aviation in La Croteuil. Croteuil?
Croteuil.
I don't know. After training in Europe for a couple more months, she returned to the U.S. in September 1921. She immediately gained the attention of newspapers, all eager to tell her extraordinary story. However, she also realized that to earn a living as a pilot, she had to become a barnstormer. Barnstorming earned its name from the aerobatic pilots who would land their light planes in fields and use local barns as venues for their impromptu air shows.
Oh.
Paying spectators would gather to watch these daring pilots attempt a variety of dangerous tricks. It's insane.
Like barrel rolls and...
Yes.
Shit like that.
Yep. To strengthen her skills as a competitive exhibition flyer, she traveled back to Europe in February 1922. She pursued an advanced course in aviation in France and visited the Netherlands and Germany for additional training. Returning to New York in August 1922, she began her career in exhibition flying. To gain publicity and exposure, she started to appear more at public events and gave dramatized speeches on her adventures. On September 3rd, 1922, she appeared for the first time in an American air show. The event, held at Curtis Field and sponsored by her friend Abbott, was in honor of the all-black 369th Infantry Regiment of World War I. She performed alongside eight other top American pilots. In December 1922, she was offered a role in a feature film titled Shadow and Sunshine. She hoped the role would give her further exposure, but the stereotypical portrayal of her race in the film disgusted her so much that she walked out of the project.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Man, like, ugh.
Those days were fucking terrible. Today is terrible, but back then it's like fucking horrible. She soon announced her goal to establish a flight school to teach aviation to people of all races, especially blacks. She managed to earn money to buy her own plane by airdropping advertising leaflets for a tire company. She never backed off from dangerous stunts and performed difficult maneuvers like figure eights, loops, and near ground dips. Oh. That would be so fucking scary.
When you're the pilot, long as you, like, if the plane's in good working order, you should be okay. Mm-hmm. But if a mechanical issue happens, holy fuck.
Oh my gosh. That'd be crazy. She met with an accident on February 22nd, 1923, which destroyed her new Ginny aircraft.
Ugh.
And injured her badly.
Dang.
Bessie was hospitalized for 3 months.
Yikes.
That would suck.
And hospitals back then were shitholes. Yes.
It took her.
But they were.
Yeah. It took her another 18 months to recover and secure new sponsors for exhibitions. Oh, that'd be so terrible not to have that income coming in. She opened a beauty shop in Orlando, Florida to raise additional money.
Back to that manicurist. Yeah.
She eventually managed to buy another Curtis JN4, but did not have enough time to establish the aviation school.
Aww.
Bessie Coleman considered it a responsibility to inspire African Americans to become pilots and attended several events to tell her story to raise interest in aviation for black people.
Hell yeah!
She spent a lot of time speaking at schools, theaters, and churches around the country, displaying clips of her aerial stunts.
Good for her.
Bessie Coleman became the first African American woman, as well as the first person of Native American descent to get a pilot's license. Performing daredevil stunts, she won the hearts of the audience and earned the nickname Queen Bess.
Yep.
On December 30th, 1916, Bessie Coleman reportedly got married to Claude Glenn, who was a friend of her brother and was 14 years older than her. However, they soon separated, and she and her family never publicly acknowledged the relationship.
Yeah.
She died on April 30th, 1926, in a plane crash while testing out her new Ginny aircraft during preparation for an exhibition for May Day celebrations.
Damn.
Coleman, who was in the second seat looking over the cockpit to prepare for the next day's show, was thrown out of the plane after pilot William D. Wills lost control of it.
See, that's why you never let a man take the wheel. They get you killed.
Fucking patriarchy, I tell you what. It's probably a white guy, too.
That's why I should have driven home.
Calm down. I was fine.
You're always fine.
In 1995, the U.S. Postal Service issued a 32-cent stamp to honor her memory. In 2006, she was inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And that...
You know how I know about Bessie Coleman?
How?
Drunk History.
Yep. Love that show. Drunk History. You can learn a lot from that show, too.
I mean, it's not completely accurate because it's drunk people telling the story.
Yeah.
But they do try.
Yeah. It's a fun show to watch.
It really is.
All right. So that's the end of that.
That's the end of that.
All right. You got anything else?
No.
Happy birthday. Love you.
Thank you. Love you, too. I should also like to dedicate this godforsaken episode to my brother.
Yes.
Miss you.
Yeah. And if you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about or know anyone who does, please email me at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook at afraidishpodcast. All the links will be in the show notes. I have this on YouTube as audio. And eventually we will have some video.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. We will hopefully do some paranormal investigating and have some extra...
little extra bonus content.
Content, yeah. We just want to pull some more people to the YouTube and watch. And then if we could, like, get some extra, like, amazing content, like, I don't know what we would have to Patreon...
Oh, yeah.
Because I would love to make some money doing this.
I think it's a little premature to be thinking Patreon right now, though, honestly.
There are podcasts that have Patreon set up in the beginning.
Yeah. But they probably also have financial backing from...
Yeah, they do.
Production companies and things.
Yeah, I don't know. You can listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Pandora, and almost anywhere you listen to podcasts. Also, rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And rate on Spotify. 5 stars, please. And if iTunes is still a thing, iTunes as well.
Okay.
All right. Until next time, don't be afraid of the dark.
Be afraid-ish of what's in it.
Bye.
Okay, bye. Excuse me, ma'am. I hear tell that you've got 15 dildos up in this here house. we're gonna have to come and search your home.